right, guys? Ah, there it was. The first stage of grief. Denial. The three of us held hands as the plane started to land, which was the first time I'd ever wanted a plane's wheels to hit the tarmac and take right back off again. Because once we landed, we were going to be reconnected with the world and have the nightmare confirmed. We got off the plane as quickly as we could, mainly because there was one old lady in our section who clapped during the Trump announcement, and I didn't want to be responsible for accidentally pushing my carry-on near her and breaking the old broad's hip. How quickly I had moved on to stage two. Anger. I stormed through the terminal and out of the adult Disneyland that is duty-free. My anger was bubbling inside me so furiously that I didn't even smile at the double cartons of Marlboros that they arranged to look like one of those giant boxes of cigarettes. Normally, an ace in the hole to make me cheer up. It took all I had not to grab a 3-foot-long Toblerone and go all Beyonce in the Hold Up video to work out some anger. But there was no time. I had to get checked into the hotel and shellac my face before heading to the panel. The thought of sitting and talking about something as trivial as the legacy of social media was unfathomable to me. After we checked into our rooms, I took the world's fastest shower and hopped into an Uber to head straight to my panel. The driver had the radio playing, and I understood nothing except the word Trump being said every 30 seconds. It was driving me crazy to not know every detail, but I blocked it out and took the 20-minute ride to scribble down some questions in my little notebook. Sure, they were the same generic drivel you'd hear at any other panel, but I was planning on putting my own unique flair on them, a.k.a. curse words. I cannot go any closer. I have to drop you off here, the driver said as we approached the bustling convention center. I hopped out of the car, immediately regretting wearing new shoes. 10 yards of walking, and I could tell the sides of my ankle boots were scraping against my skin. 20 yards, and I already needed a Band-Aid. After checking into the center, I was guided to the room I'd be speaking in by an adorable Portuguese man, Alberto, who looked all of 18 years and 4 foot nothing. This convention is a lot bigger than I thought it would be, I said, out of breath and hobbling a few feet behind. Yes, it's the biggest of its kind in Europe, he called back, bobbing and weaving between patrons and lanyards and barkers trying to get you over to their booth. I swear to God, at one point, I ducked down to not be hit in the face with a drone. 3 inches closer, and it would have given me a hell of a mullet. Alberto cleared it by a foot. We finally burst through the doors to the outside, only to re-enter into another massive expo hall, then another, and another, until Alberto flashed his badge to a giant security dude and dropped me off in a green room. Just in time, too, because I'm pretty sure at any moment my cute new tan Steve Maddens were going to be soaked crimson from blood. There's food, drink, whatever you need. When you're 20 minutes out from your panel, someone will come brief you. And if there's nothing else you need, I'll be going. Enjoy Lisbon. Wait, Alberto, do you know how big the room I'm speaking to is? Like, how many people will be in there? He cleared his throat. Ah, yes, of course. The room is 1,000, he said. 1,000? I didn't have the brain capacity to sound eloquent in front of a room of quadruple digits. Surely I had misheard. For a second there, I thought you said 1,000. Oh, no, he said as I started to maniacally laugh. Good, because my brain is way too crazy right now to get up in front of that many. I said 15,000. And that space I just left represents my blacking out for the next few minutes. I only came to with the use of smelling salts, a.k.a. beelining it to the food and stuffing my face with anxiety fries. No. This can't be happening, I thought to myself. I'd done a million of these panels, and the largest room I'd ever seen was 600. 15,000 people? That's like a goddamn AC/DC arena show. I surveyed the room as I continued putting fries in my mouth like they'd just announced a potato famine, and these were the last ones I was going to see for a while. The stage was massive, and the screens for close-ups were even bigger. I imagined my jet-lagged, puffy eyes from crying all morning projected 30 feet wide and shuddered at the thought. When my debriefer came to meet me, I was already catapulted face-first into stage 3. Bargaining. I just had no idea the room was going to be this big, and I'm totally ill-prepared, and obviously this is a traumatic morning to be an American, and I kept rattling off reasons to try to get out of it to the nodding, patient woman who was leading me on stage. Could I bail? No. They flew me out here. Hell, they flew the three of us out here. There was no way out. I had to pull myself up by my bloody bootstraps, block out the football arena worth of onlookers and the impending crumbling of America as a whole, and talk about the importance of Instagram. God damn it! My name was announced, and I walked onto the stage. Let me tell you guys, the only thing stranger than being cast out in front of an amphitheater full of people is being cast out in front of an amphitheater of silent people. There might have been thousands of bodies in that room, but you could have heard a mouse whisper a secret. I pulled out my tiny notebook, saw my swollen face on the monitor, attempted a Trump joke to the silent faces of the audience, and dove in. Guys, I am not exaggerating when I say that I don't remember one goddamn thing that happened for the next hour. I vaguely recall nodding and smiling while the two guys talked, all while I was having my own internal conversation that was a mix of fighting off a panic attack and internally screaming. Like, I could hear what they were saying, but I was having a completely different experience in my head. By some grace of God that I don't believe in, I looked down, and the countdown clock on stage to let us know how much time we had left was down to 30 seconds. I thanked the two vloggers for joining me, signed off to the upsnorious crowd, and hightailed it off the stage. I was so relieved, I think the corners of my dehydrated fry mouth even upturned into a smile. See, that wasn't so bad, the debriefer said as she led me back to the green room. I had a fleeting moment where things were looking up. That is, until I looked up and saw a group of folks gathered around one of the monitors backstage. I grabbed a white wine from the bar and edged my way closer to the screen. There she was. It was Hillary conceding. Enter stage 4. Depression. I practically chugged my Vino Verde as Hillary finished her eloquent and inspiring speech, making sure that little girls everywhere never gave up on their dreams. After the speech ended, I couldn't watch the commentary anymore. The depression was too real. I needed to get the hell out of this massive clusterfuck, get to my girls, and finally have that delicious dinner. It was as if I had been digging a tunnel with a spoon, a la Shawshank Redemption, and that delicious dinner was the light at the end. I was going to finally get to it and use that spoon to dig into something delicious. 15,000 people? Jocelyn shouted at me as I joined them at a cute table on a classic Lisbon-tiled sidewalk. Yep, and my 15-minute Uber took an hour and 15 minutes to get there, so it probably cost $900. Will you order me a double gin and tonic? I'm about to piss myself. I headed to the bathroom, clunking along in the still very painful Steve Maddens. After taking a piss longer than Tom Hanks in A League of Their Own, I attempted to leave the sliding door bathroom and realized, I was stuck. I tried again. The door was still not moving. Of course. I banged on the door again and again, but no one could hear me in the bustling restaurant. I sat on the toilet defeated. Tears started to well up in my eyes, and all the previous stages of grief were taking a bonus lap through my body. The denial. This can't be happening. I can't be stuck in a bathroom. The anger. Why the fuck can I not catch a break today? The bargaining. Please just let me out and I'll never go to the bathroom again. Just let me have one drink. The depression. Well, I live here now. This is my new home. This tiny bathroom in the back of a bar in Lisbon. But rather than accept it, I grabbed on to the anger and beat on the door and screamed my head off until eventually someone heard me. Three big waiters had to use all their might to let me out. I drank a record, 2 double gin and tonics and a glass of red in under 30 minutes. And then we took off to walk the small cobblestone streets of the Barrio Alto neighborhood to find a spot to eat. Since leaving L.A., I had only eaten that tiny plate of patatas bravas at JFK and the anxiety fries at the convention center. My body was begging for something that wasn't a tater. Eventually, we strolled up to a crowded alfresco place that looked appealing. Scanning the menu, I saw the 3 greatest words a girl can read. Nope, not I love you. I'm talking vegan vegetable sausage. It was as if choirs of angels were singing from the heavens. Here we were in Meat Central Lisbon, and we finally found a place where my dinner could be something other than carbs. Maybe my day was turning around. We went hard on the wine and kept attempting to talk about anything but the election, but we always circle back to it. Even on this beautiful old street, with a bottle of delicious red, surrounded by friends, we couldn't shake it off for a second. But my despair turned to hope as soon as that veggie brat hit the table. I was sleep-deprived, and hungry, and mildly drunk, and ready to take it to the face. Fuck a knife and fork, I said. I picked up that sucker and bit right into it. Or at least I tried. Turns out that Lisbon's idea of a veggie sausage was stuffing some ground-up vegetables into an industrial-strength plastic. It was like trying to bite into a sleeve of saltines with a wrapper still on. My dreams of a delicious dinner clearly were dashed. I cannot believe this shitty wiener. What a disappointing, full-of-shit, piece of plastic wiener, I said, the weight of the past 36 hours coming to a head. You talking about your meal or our new president. Hey-o, Jocelyn said, nudging me and refilling my wine. And I finally laughed. The first time since we'd boarded in L.A. There it was, stage 5, acceptance. The acceptance wasn't about the election results in any way, shape, or form, or being okay with what was happening back in the States. I don't mean that type of acceptance, but accepting that this was my reality, that I had gone from the hope of Hillary to the reality of Donald Trump in one plane flight, that I spoke to a room of 15,000 people but somehow didn't recall a single moment of it, that I got stuck in a bathroom for 20 minutes, and now I was eating this sorry excuse for a vegan meal. But I wasn't going to let it ruin this trip, so I asked for a sharper knife and dug right into that heavy-duty condom filled with vegetables. And wouldn't you know it, it tasted terrible. Ugh. Fact is, it was a bad wiener. But 24 hours later, and I would be in the presence of a different wiener. No, I didn't hook up with anyone in Italy. I mean the most famous of wieners, Michelangelo's David. I stood in front of that masterpiece, dwarfed by its wonder, in awe of its beauty. And then I positioned myself so it looked like I was cupping its junk for an Instagram post. You can see in the picture in the PDF just how perfectly placed that wiener is in my palm. Class act, through and through. I didn't know if this shit show was going to be for the next 4 years or 4 months or the world was changing and it would be forever. But I know that in that moment, I was happy with my friends. And everybody needs to take those little moments when they come and not let them be tainted by the greater problems. Fact is, sometimes you're served a shitty wiener, but the only thing you can do is grab life by the balls, or David's, and try to laugh your way through it. The Irish Hello. If you don't know who Grace Helbig is, then I'm assuming that you haven't logged onto the internet since it was dial-up. Grace has been a major web presence since 2008. She's an OG YouTuber, a godfather of jump cuts, a proverbial pilgrim of putting shit on the web. She's also one of my closest friends. How close, screams the audience listening to this book. So close, we recently bought a vacation home together in Palm Springs, and the cops came on the first night. Grace and I met at the People's Improv Theater in New York City in 2007. She was already performing on an improv team, but I had taken only one class there when we were put together on a house sketch team. On the night of our first show, I was nervous, but that all went away the second we got on stage, pretending to be a duo of party starters named Mitts and Fitz in our first sketch. I knew that if I went up on a line, it didn't matter, because Grace could just think of something hilarious off the top of her head to get the laugh. She had my back, I had hers, and it's been like that on stage ever since. I cannot tell you how many tours Grace and I have done together in the past decade. Along with Hannah Hart, we've performed our No Filter show everywhere from basement rock clubs in Boston to gorgeous old theaters in Melbourne, Australia. And Grace and I have taken our two-person show, This Might Get Weird, Y'all, throughout the United States. I've watched her sing ballads about French bulldogs she follows on Instagram and do interpretive dances about getting a toilet clogged at a party. But Grace's most impressive performance is always offstage, in her seamless, utterly perfect execution of an Irish goodbye. Okay, so we all know what an Irish goodbye is, right? If you don't, congrats on being a person who has actual manners when leaving a social function. An Irish goodbye is when, instead of going around the room, announcing that you're leaving a party or gathering, you just dip the fuck out without telling a soul. Irish goodbyes are great for getting out of the whole rigmarole of endlessly repeating, we have to get together soon, and hugging random people you had 10-second conversations with in line for the bathroom. They also come in handy when someone shows up that you want to avoid, or when you realize you are definitely the drunkest person at the party and you need to excuse yourself before you end up in unflattering Snapchats. Now, why is it called an Irish goodbye? No clue. I tried to officially research it and found no results. In my experience, Irish people aren't particularly known to leave in that manner. In fact, I used to frequent the hell out of a true Irish bar in Brooklyn called the Irish Haven. The owner was a cop, and after last call at 4 a.m., they just locked the doors and continued drinking. There weren't Irish goodbyes at this bar. There weren't even goodbyes, period, because no one ever left. Grace has elevated this curtain call to new heights. You can be having a deep convo with her, turn around for 1 second to get another mini quiche, and blam! Bitch is gone by the time you turn around. I'm genuinely surprised she hasn't added elements like smoke bombs or lasers to jazz up her exits. But her illustrious career of Irish goodbyes doesn't have shit on the one time we got Irish hello'd. Picture this. It's November 2016. I had been back in the States after blocking out the election results for a week. As soon as my feet hit American soil from my Italian adventure, I was waist-deep in the depression of it all. I was watching the news nonstop, like that scene in A Clockwork Orange where the guy's eyes are strapped open and he's forced to watch all those terrible images, except I was the one forcing my eyes open as to not miss anything. It got to the point where I started waking up in the middle of the night and refreshing CNN on my phone. Simply put, I couldn't handle it. Nothing felt funny. So my antidote for not being able to laugh was to hopefully make someone else laugh. I needed to get on stage and ideally put another stamp in my passport. Luckily, Grace felt the same way. We can name the show Adopt Us and frame the whole thing like we're trying to get adopted by our audience so we don't have to come back to America, Grace said as I told her over one of our midday vodka soda ketchups in my kitchen. I'll call the boys, I said, meaning our joint managers we've had since Grace and I were whippersnappers in Brooklyn. You could hear the hesitation in their voices when we told them the plan over speakerphone. It was as if we were their two teen daughters who had just turned 18. They knew we were going to do whatever we wanted, so they might as well grin through gritted teeth and say, sounds like a plan. Within the week, we had two shows booked, one on Thanksgiving Day in London and the other 2 days later in Dublin. It was on. It's also worth mentioning that this was the first time in our 9-year friendship that Grace and I were both single. And let me tell you, there's a whole new layer of friendship that is formed when neither of you is constantly texting with a boyfriend. You know that YouTube video of the two babies who are just laughing like hyenas in their diapers trying to get to the bathroom but continue falling? And that was us, but in our early 30s. Our managers had reason to be worried. But hell, they both had kids in private school and this was business, so they booked the shows. A few weeks of being glued to MSNBC later, and it was time to go. Grace had to be in New York a week before the tour, so rather than just meet her in London, I headed out a day early to meet her in New York City. The plan was to put on our sweats, lock ourselves in our hotel room, and wake up that Sunday morning with a fully fleshed-out show before our flight to London. That way, we could relax when we got there for a few days, not have the monkey on our backs of planning a show. It was a perfect plan. We never did things that far in advance. Every single time we booked a tour, we said it was going to be different, that we'd prep ahead of time. And yet every single time we ended up drinking till 3 in the morning, 36 hours before our first set, creating lyrics to an opening number and photoshopping ridiculous pictures. Like this picture that's in the PDF of the Rest in Peace Dick bicycle. Imagine that image projected 30 feet wide above our heads. While our plan to prep in New York City had great intentions behind it, we were now living in the era of single Grace and Mamrie. We work better with a buzz, we rationalized. It's like gasoline to start the engine of our brains. Let's go out to a bar. One drink turned into two. Two turned into too many. And lo and behold, both of us ended up getting white girl wasted, high-fiving each other as we parted ways to reunite with boys we knew from our past. I'll text you when I get up, I said, slurring as I entered a cab headfirst. What hotel are you in again? Grace replied, and I nodded like I heard anything over the subway rushing under the grates below her ankle boots. I got myself in and rolled down the window as the yellow cab drove off. Mace is getting laid! Mace is our ship name, the combo of our first names together. It also has an extra layer because, just like Mace Spray, when we get together, that shit can be dangerous. The next morning, I woke up freaking out. What time is it? God damn it, I fell asleep in my contacts again. I painfully squinted to see the time on the TV. It was 10:50. My stomach dropped. I had missed the 9:30 flight. Who knew how many times Grace had called, wondering where I was, and not knowing the name of the hotel? She must be livid, I thought. Livid and an hour over the Atlantic en route to London without me. Why hadn't I woken up from the alarm on my phone? Had I even set an alarm? And most important, where was my phone? I destroyed my room looking for it. I straight up picked the mattress off the bed like I was performing a drug raid. No luck. I got on my laptop to find the number for the bar we'd last been to, then went all 90s reenactor and used the landline to call them. I was hopeful until an annoyed morning shift bartender who probably takes 5 of these calls a day replied they didn't have it. I didn't know Grace's hotel either, so the only thing left was email. I typed in a panic. Grace! Holy shit, dude, I am so sorry. I think my phone must have dropped in the cab last night, but I was too drunk to notice. I just woke up. I am so sorry. I'll find another flight ASAP. I sat there anxiously, hitting refresh, until an email from Grace popped into my inbox. I clicked it to be greeted by a very chill, all good, dude, I'm just waking up too. We had both overslept. What a relief. Misery might love company, but fucking up welcomes a whole guest list. Our hangover fever dreamed us through an endless afternoon at the AT&T store, spending way too much on new flights going out that night, and trying to ward off our pulsing headaches. Come 7 o'clock and we finally had our butts in coach, ready to turn off our new phones, Grace upgraded too, and pass the hell out. We woke up in England ready to rock, and by that I mean we went to an award show, got drunk with our sordid food boys that you might remember from the Britney Spears chapter in my first book, and once again, creating our show in the 24 hours leading up to it. We might be procrastinators, but at least we have consistency going for us. Adopt Us existed, and no one asked for a refund. So with the London show under our belt, we headed to the land of Guinness. Welcome to Dublin, our dapper Irish driver said as he took the carry-ons from our shaky, hungover hands. We got the rest of our luggage from the baggage carousel and trudged slowly behind him as he pushed the cart with all our suitcases full of dirty clothes and ridiculous props. Honestly, if you think airport security is a pain in the ass, try getting your carry-ons full of props through an x-ray machine. There's nothing like holding up the line as an unamused TSA agent pulls a blow-up doll out of your bag. This is an actual thing that happened to me in Chicago after a show. No regrets. As we walked through the enclosed overpass to the parking garage, we came up behind a group of four dudes. I don't mean to help strengthen the Irish stereotype, but it was 10 a.m. and these guys were wrecked. They were wobbling harder than Tara Reid at the 1999 MTV Beach House. We passed them with a few good feet of distance so as to not draw any attention to ourselves, heads down into our phones, soaking up the last little bit of airport Wi-Fi. We were almost past these ogres when one came straight for Grace. I like your hat, he said, referring to Grace's classic knit cap with a pom-pom on top. Thank you, she said nervously and kept walking. And then this Irish asshole reaches his baseball mitt of a hand and roughly pats Grace on the head 5 times. It was like he momentarily forgot what personal space meant and decided to play whack-a-mole with a human. Grace's eyes went as wide as dinner plates. I knew my queen of hating confrontation didn't want to yell at him like he deserved. I had an, if you touch her again, I will punch you in the penis lined up in my throat, but I knew the best thing to do was to keep walking. These guys were wasted, and if they casually bonk a girl on the head as a means of morning flirting, I didn't want to see what they would do when they were pissed off. We picked up our speed and didn't say anything till we were safely in the back of the car. We were flabbergasted. I can't believe that guy touched you, I said, as our car looped around to the exit. I didn't know what to do. How did he think that's okay? Our driver paid the parking attendant as we drove under the gate. The sound of tires screeching emerged from behind us. Those tinkers got through on our parking pass and nearly rear-ended us, the driver said, his brow furrowed. For those of you not familiar with the term tinker, allow me to explain. Knowing this Irish slang is one of the many things I learned from hanging out in that aforementioned Irish bar in Brooklyn. A tinker is a word to describe a traveler, also known as a gypsy. You might have seen them on TLC's masterpiece, My Big Fat American Gypsy Wedding. It's basically Jersey Shore meets Teen Mom, but with trashy youngsters spending too much on weddings that always end in fistfights. It's essentially the equivalent of European white trash culture. And I'm allowed to say that because I've been arrested for being too drunk at a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert in Alabama. Anyway, back in the car, our driver was gripping the wheel for dear life. It was clear these guys were drunk driving, swerving a few cars behind us. As a person with car anxiety, my whole body was clenched. They then straight up fast and furious around other cars to make their way right beside us. The head bopper rolled down the window, leaned his head back, and spit on our window. You could have driven a train through our mouth with how wide our jaws dropped. And with one quick, fucking Americans, they sped off. We cracked up as soon as the shock passed. We hadn't been in Ireland for more than 15 minutes, and this is what we were greeted with? Welcome to Dublin, our driver said again. Welcome to Dublin, we repeated, laughing hysterically. And off in the distance, we watched Karma do its job as their car slammed through the side railing of an overpass and crash-landed on the ground below. That didn't happen. Karma doesn't work like that. The rest of the day went smoothly. We got our naps in and then had an awesome show, despite being a little nervous, since Dublin is the only town we've ever been heckled on a previous tour. I was feeling celebratory and ready to go at it. I think we should go out tonight, I said, sipping on a perfectly poured Guinness that the stage manager had left for me in our dressing room. Grace popped her head out of the bathroom, her face covered in neon paint. I don't know. Hasn't this day been, like, 9 years long? There she was. Old school Grace. The Grays who would need to go back and check in with a boyfriend via WhatsApp before the time change got weird. The one who would rather stay in her hotel than go out. But there was no boyfriend this time, damn it. We needed a rally. Grace, the last time we were here, we were heckled and then got into a ridiculous fight. Yeah, and that is a true story, and I bet you wish I'd write about it, but some friendship stories have to remain secret. Then there's old spit take this morning. Come on! We have to have an Irish memory that's good besides being on stage. I saw a little glimmer in her eyes. Okay, we'll go out for 2 drinks. That's it. We don't need to be losing phones or missing flights tomorrow. I pumped my fist in the air. I got her. Single Grace was coming out. We dropped our stuff off in our rooms, did a Superman and a phone booth speed change of clothes, and headed out. Luckily, we didn't have to go far because our hotel was just a couple blocks off Temple Bar, the Irish equivalent of Bourbon Street. We walked our already tipsy asses straight into the first place we saw and sidled up to the bar. There was a band playing, and the whole place was in full swing. "What can I get you, ladies?" asked the cute older bartender. "Do you have Fireball?" we asked in unison. They did not. In fact, in the land of Jameson, even asking for it was probably blasphemous. But they did have something exactly like it, so spicy cinnamon whiskey shots and Guinness it was. After about a half hour of chatting with the bartenders and listening to the band playing the traditional Irish tunes of Red Hot Chili Peppers and the Eagles, 2 dudes approached us. "Mametown and Smellbig, is it?" the one who looked like a poor man's Keanu Reeves asked. Oh, God, I thought. They're fans. I was debating in my head just how inappropriate it would be to hook up with fans before I remembered we were wearing soccer jerseys with our names on the back that we'd been given by the sweetest girl at our pre-show meet and greet. "Oh, hi, I'm Mamrie. This is Grace." We explained the shirts and that we had just done a comedy show and were in town for only one night. "Us too," said his friend, who, considering his blonde curls, could have been the bill to Keanu's Ted. "We're here doing business for one night." "What do you do?" Grace asked, motioning the eavesdropping old bartender and hot young bartender for another round. "We're in finance. We work for ING out of Amsterdam. Just had to come in for a meeting today." Grace and I shot each other looks. Bankers out of Amsterdam were not our style, and their bootcut jeans were definitely not our or anyone whose taste is after 2007 style either. But then again, we were ready to make a memory, and this was presenting itself as an interesting possibility. The young bartender set down the shots. "Do you all want one too?" Grace asked. They agreed, and we took down some flame balls, or whatever it was called, and chatted. We had to admit, they were kind of douchey, and the bartenders definitely thought we were lowering our standards by the way they were cutting eyes at us. Just then, a cute girl came over and handed the dudes a shot, winked, and walked off. "Who is that?" Grace asked. "Oh," Keanu shook his head. "She's one of our coworkers. She's actually super annoying. I think she thinks we're definitely going to hook up, but I am so not into that." Grace and I shot each other a suspicious look as the coworker kept motioning the guys to come join their group. "Ugh, we'll be back in just a sec." And with that, the Dutch Bill and Ted went over to their coworkers to join them for a shot. This was when Grace and I used our powers of being longtime friends and began communicating telepathically. Not an actual word was uttered between us, but this convo happened in our eyes. "Grace, something's up with these dudes." "Me, yeah, that was totally not a coworker." "Grace, also, they haven't offered to buy us a drink." "Me, we bought them a drink, and that girl did too." "Grace, something's fishy, and it's not just this Guinness." "Me, what do you mean?" "Grace, don't they use some kind of fish guts in the beer-making process?" "Me, fuck my life, I'm gonna pretend I didn't hear that." "Grace, by the way, why are we speaking telepathically when those dudes left and we can just use our real voices?" I cleared my throat, which was already a little scratchy from all the travel and shows and debauchery. It felt like losing my phone in New York had been 84 years earlier. "Maybe we should just pack it in for the evening," I said, barely believing the words coming out of my own mouth. "I mean, I know we're in the country of luck, but it doesn't look like we're getting lucky tonight." "No, let's wait. These dudes don't deserve an Irish goodbye." I was shocked. Grace, the queen of Irish goodbyes, was refusing to leave that old wooden bar like a hippie chained to a tree. I didn't know what was about to happen, but I knew I could trust her. Bill and Ted came back, and Grace popped into a full girl flirt mode. I followed her lead. I cannot deny or confirm if I twirled my hair with my finger. You could tell between their exchanged looks that they thought it was a done deal. A pair of shoe-ins, one might say. Meanwhile, we were about to put a metaphorical shoe in their ass. "So, tell us about your job," Grace said, adding a little L.A. vocal fry for effect. "It must be super stressful. Freddie Mac is a big company." Ted smiled. "It is, but we make time for fun," he said, placing his arm around my shoulder. Oh, really? Grace said with a smile that then fell flatter than my sixth grade chest. You said you worked at ING. You guys are full of shit. Ted looked to Bill, his eyes wide. Wait, what did we say? I picked up Ted's hand from my shoulder with two fingers, like it was a piece of litter, and handed it back to him. Oh, my God, you two could have been plumbers, and we wouldn't have cared. You blew it! We hopped off the bar stools and breezed past them as they trailed behind. You two are obviously lying, too, Keanu shouted. You weren't comedians. You haven't made us laugh once. Yeah, well, that's our job, and you're not paying us. I'd say buy a ticket, but it sounds like you don't have any money. We kept walking towards the door, but right before we got there, Grace turned on a dime. She walked right up to their female co-workers and pulled the smiley one to the side. Just so you know, those dudes aren't bankers, and they said you all were annoying. Girl comically gasped. Bet Bill and Ted wish they'd had a time-traveling phone booth then. The only people smiling harder than us were the two bartenders who'd been watching this spectacle the whole time. We changed directions and smiled right back. Turns out, despite confronting these two jerks on their terrible game, there actually was an Irish goodbye that night. And by this I mean that those two bartenders hopped right out of the bar and left with Grace and me during the middle of their shift. Our luck had changed. Fraser Ween. When it comes to doing outrageous, fun shit, a lot of people talk the talk but never walk the walk. In fact, forget walking. Some people simply crawl through life, staying low and close to the ground, careful not to get hurt or, worse, embarrass themselves. Not me. I don't just walk the walk. I want to throw on moon shoes and bounce my way through life. When it comes to the type of dumb, outrageous ideas that become legend, New Year's Eve 2016 takes the cake. Despite my general love of drinks and debauchery, I've never been a big New Year's person. There's always so much hype and expectation for things to be crazy, which to me feels like an awkward cloud of forced fun hanging above your head all night. I've had some fun ones. You might recall the mushrooms, catching myself on fire, shallow champagne tub story of New Year's 2005. But 9 times out of 10, it's a whole lot of work with not that great of a payoff. Personally, I'm a bigger fan of Halloween, my absolute favorite holiday. Besides the ability to make anything slutty, I have been a slutty Tetris piece before, I also love that it's the one day out of the year that you can scare the shit out of kids and no one bats an eye. If you rolled up on a neighbor's house any other day of the year, and the front yard was covered with fake dismembered hands and feet, and a man pretending to be a scarecrow only to terrify the living hell out of your kids and then try to make nice with them with a mini Snickers, that shit would not fly. But on Halloween, sure, why not? Throw in a chainsaw while you're at it to really solidify some nightmares. In September of 2016, I met up with my friends Scotty and Flula to get some drinks. Scotty is a friend I've known about 8 years since back in the Brooklyn days. He is a hilarious comedy writer and even better drinker and is always down for a weird time. We share the same mentality when it comes to doing something for the sake of randomness. Flula is one of the funniest motherfuckers on the planet. He looks like he might have been an experiment by the German government because he is tall and perfectly built. With his thick accent and affinity for fanny packs and dancing, he's basically a Bavarian party Ken doll. So there we were, sitting in our swivel chairs at our go-to bar, Tex. Tex is one of those rare places that hasn't changed at all since opening in 1972, with its plaid carpeting and its menu full of things like coq au vin and escargot. Sure, there are your standard hipsters who filter through the bar on a nightly basis, but for the most part, you are delightfully surrounded by old people slurping on mussels and croque madames. My favorite sighting I've ever had there was Ron Jeremy, the godfather of porn actors, sitting by himself, eating a big bowl of soup with a napkin tucked into the neck of his shirt while watching the news on the bar's TV. Just goes to show ya, you can have sex with more than 2,000 people on camera and still end up eating your minestrone alone. Anyway, Scotty and Flula and I were shooting the shit over some cocktails and got around to talking about Halloween. I don't remember what I've done for Halloween since I moved here, I admitted. I went to a party last year, but I don't really want to go to one this year, Scotty said. But I used to love Halloween, I said, beginning to get really bummed about a love that was once so passionate. At one point in my life, I had started planning my costumes months in advance, and now I just ask my friends what they were up to the day before and half-heartedly do whatever was easiest, like a lover planning intricate dates for a partner, then years later just saying, let's order Domino's. Let's do something very weird this year. Very strange, Flula said after his third bullet on the rocks. Now, I don't remember what sparked this idea, but by our fifth round, we had decided that the funniest thing alive would be if we, along with some other recruits, went out for Halloween in Seattle dressed as the cast of Frasier. In case you aren't well-versed in Kelsey Grammer's catalog, Frasier was a TV show that took place in Seattle. It was 100% silly sitcom antics at its finest, involving two uppity brothers whose crotchety masculine dad comes to live with them and hijinks ensue. When I was watching it as a youngin, I don't think I even understood most of the jokes, but I still loved it. They spoke so eloquently and were always drinking sherry and quoting old plays. I felt classier just watching it, despite being a kid in bumfuck North Carolina, sitting on a tie-dyed beanbag eating veggie nuggets. I would want to be the dad's recliner and make people sit on me, I said, having no fucking clue how someone would pull off making a recliner costume. I would be the space needle, Flula said, his eyes getting as wide as ping pong balls. You would both be inanimate objects, Scotty asked as we nodded. Well, I would be Frasier. I think if I grew my hair out for a couple weeks, I could pull it off. The night progressed and our ideas for the event got more and more specific. We would have a solid crew of 8 to round out the other characters and prop pieces. Seemed doable. And then someone had the genius idea that we would rent a party bus and do a bar crawl, blasting the Frasier theme song each time we rolled into the bar. We can call it Frasierween, I said, knee-deep in vodka at this point. Frasierween, we all said in unison. We kept on brainstorming till the place closed, which wasn't that late because, as I said, the majority of the clientele are well into their 70s. The next day, we all texted about what a fun idea it was. We were fired up and wanted to pull it off. But days turned into weeks and all our schedules becoming insane, and sure enough, Halloween was right on our heels and we hadn't done any planning. We found ourselves back at Tex. We really dropped the ball on that one, I said. I guess we can always do it next Halloween. Frasier is timeless, after all. I looked over to see Scotty scheming. I can tell when he has an idea he's excited to share but is still gathering his thoughts because his eyes squint a little and his upper lip curls in like Fire Marshal Bill, displaying his front teeth. Doesn't necessarily have to be Halloween, he said. Flula and I leaned in, ready to hear what dumb shit was about to follow. What if we went up there for New Year's? It would almost be more fun because people would be so confused why we're all in costumes. Flula and I looked at each other. It was taking an already weird event and making it even stranger. But everything is so packed on New Year's Eve. Do we really want to go out in big costumes to packed bars? Flula asked, concern in his eyes. True. Last year, I wanted to avoid crowds so bad that I literally went and ate Chinese food 3 blocks from my place, drank a couple of glasses of champagne on my couch, and was asleep by 11, I said. What if we went out on December 30th? Flula said with a mischievous look. We all sat there, thinking about it for a second. Then one by one, we grinned like silent idiots. That is perfect, I said. Scotty leaned back in his swivel chair, folding his hands and nodding at the ceiling. A modern-day equivalent of Auguste Rodin's The Thinker. This could work, he said, still nodding. That way the bars aren't super crowded, and then when we're all hungover on New Year's Day, everybody can do whatever they want. There's no pressure. It was decided. This was happening. Despite my doubts, I knew it was locked in when Scotty sent his flight info to Flula and me, a move more official than tagging someone you've just started dating in a pic on Instagram. We needed to invite more folks, but who would be willing to travel to Seattle? Luckily for us, we had a few friends from New York City who were going to be there anyway. Scotty invited his girlfriend, and Flula had a friend who lived there who was also down. It was all coming together. We had a solid 8 folks, and we were off and running. Anticipation grew with the coming months until finally I was on my flight to Seattle. My heart was filled with excitement, and my checked luggage was filled with a recliner costume that I had made with foam core, hot glue, striped fabric, a nude onesie, and a lot of hope that it wouldn't fall apart immediately. I got checked into my hotel, which was a corner suite, ooh la la, and waited for the rest of the crew to trickle in throughout the day. That night, we sat at the hotel bar, drinking too many rounds, and figuring out our bar route for the next night's festivities. We were all going to do our thing during the day and then meet downstairs at 5 for a drink. The party bus would be arriving at 6. To say the next night was epic is an understatement. To say it was very drunk is a lie. It was beyond. As you can see from the attached picture in the PDF, we had our classic Frasier, brother Niles, dad Marty, producer Roz, a recliner, a space needle, a piano, and Eddie the dog. The real dog was just a temporary loner. Despite Seattle being all cool and weird, they wouldn't let a canine come on the bar crawls. The rest of the night became a blur of bars, doing as we promised and blaring the Frasier theme song from a portable speaker we carried with us. In fact, that is the only thing we played on the party bus, too. If I had to guess, I would say we played that theme song 400 times. Every time we entered a bar, we were met with two reactions. People would ask us what we were doing, and one of us would say in our own variation, "We are celebrating Frasierween, a holiday we made up where you go on a bar crawl dressed as the cast of Frasier." The only rule being that it can't be on an actual holiday. People either went, "Oh, got it," and nodded, clearly confused, or said, "That's amazing, can I get a pic?" By the time we were all very inebriated and got to our fourth bar, a tiki-themed spot with karaoke, our group started dropping like flies. My friend, dressed as Niles, got to the point where she was just housing pizza at the bar, looking so upset you would have thought Daphne had just dumped her. "Excuse me?" A lady with a sweet face approached me, holding her boyfriend's hand. He looked nervous, perhaps because he was watching a striped recliner do the Dougie. "Excuse me, I hate to bother you, but my boyfriend and I saw you all, and we were wondering, are you the cast of Frasier?" "You know it," I said, still dancing. At this point, the boyfriend face-palmed his forehead and started shaking his head, grinning ear to ear. "I told you, oh my God, this is amazing." He was in awe. The girlfriend piped in, "You don't understand. That is his favorite show. He's obsessed. So when he saw you guys walk in, he freaked out." "With good reason. It's an amazing show," I said, taking a seat in a chair beside me. I went on to explain to them at length what Frasierween was. I mean it when I say that the boyfriend's eyes were lit up and he was open-mouthed smiling like he was in sex ed and just learning about the glory of doing it. When I finished, the girlfriend chimed in again. "Would it be okay if..." He cut her off, looking bashful. "No, it's okay. Don't act embarrassed. I'm drunk as a skunk dancing in a recliner costume. What do you want?" Girlfriend continued. "Can he take a picture with you?" "Only if he sits on my lap." I patted my seat cushion, and he approached me with the excitement and hesitation that is usually only seen when a 4-year-old is up next to see Santa Claus. He plopped down on my lap. His girlfriend snapped a few pics, and then he hopped right up. "Thank you so much. This is incredible." He smiled and started to walk away. His girlfriend lingered for a second and then leaned in when he was out of earshot, which wasn't hard because someone was wailing on some Radiohead on the karaoke mic. "Seriously, thank you. We got engaged over Thanksgiving, and this moment is probably the highlight of his year." That alone made this entire spectacle worth it. After the bar, the night got blurry. The next morning, I woke up, and it looked like someone had hired a set designer to make my suite look like a drunk girl had come home to it. It was textbook. My purse was dropped right at the door, with all its content sprawled everywhere. My bodysuit was crumpled right in front of the toilet, indicating I had pulled it down to urinate and just kicked it off right there. An entire bottle of minibar wine was opened, of which I drank 2 sips before passing out, but definitely forgot to recork, so that $40 bottle of wine was ruined. $20 a sip! I spent a good part of the day recovering before dragging myself out to explore. Our hotel was a block from a pier with a Ferris wheel on it. I trudged my crazy brain self down there, grabbing a snack on the way. That snack being a pack of candy cigarettes that allowed for this official Ferris wheel pic that's attached. The rest of the day was perfectly lazy. Everyone came over to my suite to receive their surprise satin baseball jackets, complete with the official Frasierween #1 patch that Scotty had designed. We got Thai food. We all piled back in my suite wearing robes and watched some New Year's Eve coverage. We were zonked and so happy to not be out in the madness. When the clock struck midnight, I found myself sitting in a hot bath with a glass of wine. Ringing in the New Year in a tub? Sound familiar? It's exactly how I ended my first book. But unlike a decade earlier, I wasn't on mushrooms and sitting in 6 inches of room temp champagne. I was submerged in hot bubbles and drinking a classy red. I was a mature woman in my 30s now, and times were changing faster than ever. Ashley, the girl I used to drink bottles of pop-off vodka with, would soon be giving bottles to a little baby. I was dating for the first time in my adult life. My friendships with women had grown stronger and more supportive. I could focus on my career and pursue opportunities unabashedly. And I was happy. I heard once that with the rate your body regenerates its cells, you're basically a new person every 7 years. I felt like my heart and brain had been on a regenerating fast track those past 12 months, learning who I was on my own. Truly independent, not just an independent mind with someone to seal in all the cracks. I was proud of myself. Proud of the boozy, solo-dancing adult I'd become. Proud of my southern accent that I still clung to. Proud that I was unapologetically driven by work, which allowed me this ridiculous life I was so thankful to carve out. I was proud of this new brain and heart. But I was also exhausted. Perhaps I should take a few months when I get back to L.A. and take it easy, I thought, as I turned on the shower, because I am no animal that just sits in their own stew without a rinse afterward. Buckle down and get my adult on for a minute. And that's exactly what I did. I boarded my flight to L.A. the next morning, content with my adventures from the year before, and ready to drop anchor. When my plane started taxiing that morning and the pilot came on the intercom, he greeted us with a, "Happy New Year, everybody. This is your pilot speaking. Our flight time to Los Angeles today is about 4 hours and 25 minutes. I snuggled into my window seat and looked out as we ascended into the clouds, knowing that when we touched down, I would be taxiing into a calmer, more mature year ahead of me. Guys, come on. We have been together a couple hundred pages here. You should know that there's no damn way I was going out like that. Instead, the captain came on and let us know that it would be a smooth and easy flight to New Orleans. Remember that first guy on Raya who caught my attention by complimenting my dog? Well, after I got out of the tub that night, we texted about how fun it would be to spend the first few days of the new year ripping it up in the Big Easy. Naturally, I changed my flight. After all, I don't want to be telling the same stories over and over again. It was time to go make some more. Until next time, XOXO, Mamrie. Okay, can you imagine if I earnestly ended my book with an XOXO like I'm Gossip Girl or something? See you next time, suckers. This is Mamrie Hart. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of I've Got This Round, More Tales of Debauchery. This program was directed by Aaron Spencer, executive producer Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by Mamrie Hart. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.